pronouncement of Her Majesty's Parliament at Westminster. My lords, ladies and gentlemen, there has been of late far too much bouncing, waltzing, funky chickening, dinky two-stepping and generally larking about throughout the land in a feckless and undignified manner. For the good of the country, all this must now cease. From this day forth, it will be an offence for any subject of this land to enjoy himself in any way whatsoever.
Cobblers!
These laws are to be enforced by the government's specially trained and ruthlessly efficient operatives, the Mirth Inspectors! Let it be noted that the aforenamed Mirth Inspectors are hereby empowered to restrain any citizen found in the act or pursuit of pleasure, delight, amusement or entertainment, including all forms of diversion, pastime, pleasure, high life, hot time in the old town tonight, carnival, fiesta, orgy, guests and games, romps, rollicks, skyarms, rollicks, tricks and foolishness. All exaltation, celebration, vindication and jubilation are henceforth and forever banned, barred, tabooed, out of bounds, and against the law of the land.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers once more. In the second part, Trump and Biden decide to cancel their scheduled TV debate, instead heading out on rallies where they can both say exactly what they want with no embarrassing questions getting in the way. What now passes for democracy in one of the greatest put-up job double Muppet elections of all time. But back this side of the pond, and another picture entirely as the UK stands up to the lies with evidence of COVID test fraud. And the views of the Welsh outside their Cardiff Parliament in glorious sunshine on Sunday. The pandemic profiteers ramping up false positives to justify more and more millions of our money, their Serco. And they've done it many times before, paying hundreds of millions in fines for fraud. But they didn't count on Bournemouth-based investigative journalist and MC Lance Murdoch, otherwise known as LL MC. We'll be hearing his forensic look at the world's biggest COVID fraudsters and their links to Buckingham Palace through the shadowy Purbright Institute, which also controls privatised defence evaluation and research establishment, that's Kinetic. And we hear one of his tunes, Don't Believe Me, too. Not only that, an exclusive interview with Lance about his COVID awakening ended with a focus on the Great Reset and what to expect. And as the UN General Assembly closes, we'll hear one of his last speeches from 2009, carried over from last week, the late, great Colonel Gaddafi. And we've all heard of the Grand Master of Scottish Rite Freemasons, well, the BBC don't seem to have heard of him, but anyway. But the United States, Albert Pike, set up a plan for world wars and revolutions to bring about world revolution. Three world wars and a totalitarian government. Webster Tarpley this week on Pike's counterpart, who formulated the plan, apparently, with him from Italy. He invented the mafia, by the way. His name, Giuseppe Mazzini. But, Martin, starting this week, we've got... I know you were just checking your phone, because today's a big day, isn't it? Apparently an announcement about Brexit and whether... Actually, that's it, is it? What do you think?
Well, I just looked at my phone a minute ago. I think they haven't completely ruled out carrying on negotiations next week, but they're flagging up that possibly nothing's going to come from them. So we're still not quite sure what's going on.
Well, it's been like this for about four years or so now.
Yeah, but I mean, we're going to find out which way the cookie's going to crumble very shortly.
Now, whose fault is it if there is a no-deal Brexit?
Well, ultimately, there are many people in the Tory party who want a no-deal Brexit. So,
no, but whose fault is it? Because, I mean, it takes two to tango at any negotiations, doesn't it?
It does, but, I mean, the point is that effectively, we could have had any deal we wanted if we wanted to stay in the single market like Norway or Switzerland. And it's been interpreted, even though during the referendum campaign, Farage and others said, we're not leaving the single market, that's scaremongering.
Well, it's not Farage that's in charge, is it?
No. No, but I mean, the same goes for Cummings.
I mean, the British establishment has decided, not really Cummings or Boris or anybody else, has decided that they want sovereignty, and the idea that they're going to be in the single market where you're still under the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. It's you know, nobody seems in the establishment anyway, and actually I suppose most of the people that actually voted for Brexit want to have a continued you know, legislation from or judicial oversight by Brussels. The idea is we can actually do it all right on our own.
Yeah, but I mean, I come back to the point, you either want to stay in the single market or you don't. And if you were prepared to stay in the single market, then all sorts of deals are possible. Well, but if you want to leave the single market, then you can't really expect to have access to the single market.
The argument against it, of course, is that if you're in the single market, what you're doing is you're abiding by all the rules, but you won't have any say in how they're put together, unless you want to actually go back into the EU proper, as you know, France and Germany are, for example.
Well, that is exactly the point. I mean, you could have. I mean, Norway has had two referendums on joining the EU. Both times they voted to stay out because they don't really want to waste any money sending people to Brussels, to the European Parliament, etc. But they've accepted being in the single market because they see it as in their interest to be in the single market. And that, in fact, was during the referendum campaign. We were told that if we vote to leave the EU, we're not necessarily leaving the single market. So, in other words, what's happened is it's gradually been radicalised to the point where staying in the single market is not Brexit. And, of course, most people didn't even, I bet you most people who voted in that referendum had no idea what the single market was.
This is a circular argument we're having here, you know. So, you know, either you're in or you're out of the political structures. And if you're in the single market, you're still in those.
So if you want to leave the single market, then that implies that you get no deal.
But anyway, Boris is saying, actually what he's been saying today is we've got to prepare for a no deal Brexit. Now, I wonder if they are prepared, because
the answer is no.
Yeah.
We know that.
In what way? How do we know that?
Because they're basically, the business has not done, they've done none of the preparations necessary for a no deal Brexit. They've just presumed that somehow it'll work. And given the way in which they've managed virtually everything else since they've come to pass at the last election, I'm not at all confident that they have got a plan in place to deal with the consequences.
Well, maybe their plan is to do with the covert intelligence and security bill, which is to take extraordinary powers to government agencies to commit crimes, to run an incredibly draconian system whereby whatever they say goes. I mean, it almost sounds as if they're expecting some kind of uprising like an Arab Spring or even a civil war.
Well, I find it quite extraordinary that any government would give its own security forces and other government agencies the right to commit crimes. I mean, are we a state of laws or not? Things that are illegal are illegal. They're illegal for individuals. They're illegal for the government.
Yeah, but the guy you voted for, Keir Starmer, Martin, to lead the Labour Party, is all for this. He wants his MPs to abstain. Mm. And there's been a revolt this week, hasn't there, of the MPs who are saying, actually, no, this is no good. So what is Starmer doing supporting this whole idea of these various Tory-controlled organisations with a licence to kill, bug and burgle their way around the country?
Well, you may well ask. I think it's very disappointing that he's taking the line that he is taking. I can see the politics of it is that he doesn't want to be seen to be undermining the security services, because he wants to give the impression that he's an insider, an establishment man, and therefore the security services are, you know, to be given carte
blanche. So he wants to give more power to the security services than everybody else in the hope that they will then be favourable to him.
Well, I think
he's... Who's running the show here?
Well, basically, he is... You know, he's been director of public prosecutions. He's met the people top of MI5 and all the rest of it. And, I mean, as you can see, the more radical members of the Labour Party are not willing to give the security services a blank check. And given that they have been, in fact, caught out carrying out various illegal operations, the Special Demonstration Squad had hundreds of, literally hundreds of infiltrators into radical and environmental movements, basically engaging in all sorts of criminal activity.
It's one of the fascinating things about...
And that's just that.
One of the fascinating things about this, Martin, is the way that the far right were almost ignored. I mean, you know, almost all these organisations were environmental campaigns, social justice campaigns of all different stripes, But in fact, most of them hadn't actually committed crimes. They weren't criminals that were being... It's almost like you've got your undercover cop that's infiltrating a group, which is not even a criminal group.
Yeah, it's basically our version of the Stasi. And, of course, they've been doing it for years. It is, in fact, illegal. And, of course, people could, in theory, be prosecuted.
So this whole thing was rammed through yesterday, the third reading of the bill yesterday. I understand it's now just the royal assent that it has to have. But left-wing Labour MPs, the Daily Mail says, defy Keir Starmer, with 34, including Jeremy Corbyn, opposing this licence to kill law. I would be, take it so far as to say this is like the Gestapo Act, because it does allow these agencies to really do what they want. They are above the law. If somebody in one of those agencies has got a vendetta against somebody, or just is got up out of bed on the wrong side, then that they are now empowered to go... Actually, to behave like criminals and terrorists, effectively.
Well, they did.
Terrorism is not ruled out by this.
No, of course. Well, don't forget, the British military orchestrated the Loyalist terror campaign in Northern Ireland for decades, killing hundreds of people. And they knew exactly what they were doing, and they knew it was illegal at the time, but they did it. And in theory, of course, they could be prosecuted, just like the people who bombed Bologna Railway Station, or Piazza Fontana, or the killings in the supermarket massacres in Belgium. I mean, basically, the Western intelligence services have always been engaged in terrorism.
I mean, the only reason...
They're now getting a get-out-of-jail-free
card. The only way the Tories can get away with this, because there's quite a few Tory rebels against this as well, is because Keir Starmer is so behind it. And if we had a different leader for the Labour Party, for Jeremy Corbyn, for example... or even a Labour Prime Minister, this would never have happened. So do you ever feel a bit guilty about, you know, pushing the Remain strategy, which many people think led to Corbyn failing and losing in order to put, and also to put Keir Starmer into power in the Labour Party, Martin? Because someone like Rebecca Long-Bailey, you can imagine that if she'd been in charge, you would almost certainly see some much wider revolt against this and much more publicity, because that's the stunning side to all of this, I think, this covert Human Intelligence Sources Bill, soon to become Act, is the complete lack of publicity that it's had. And if you don't speak out against it as a politician, and your name is something other than Jeremy Corbyn, because he always gets suppressed by the mass media, you know, hopefully there would have been a bit of a public debate about this, but there's been virtually nothing.
Well, I think what's interesting in relation to this is it's not just the Labour Party. I think other opposition parties
have
voted against.
They have. Anyway, the main speech, I mean, we heard from Zara Sultana, my favourite MP, I have no bones about saying that, from last week. We heard from her talking about this bill. And so tonight we're going to have a listen to Jeremy Corbyn. And here is his entire speech, which, I mean, it was an incredibly short debate, Martin. I think it was only, 2 hours or something. The entire bill was supposed to be debated in its committee stage, and they were really annoyed about it, the MPs. But let's have a listen to the former Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who shot himself in the foot by not backing Brexit and by failing to deal with the Israel lobby within his own party. So in a way, it's his own fault that he's on the back benches, possibly. So let's have a listen to what he had to say about this covert human intelligence sources bill yesterday.
Thank you very much, Madam Deputy Speaker. And the proceedings on this bill today are an absolute travesty of parliamentary accountability. That a major bill like this, with huge implications for civil rights and human rights in our society, our standing around the world, should be pushed through in a very short time this afternoon. I suspect we won't even be voting on most of the amendments. They haven't been subject to standalone debates. We're having, in effect, another second reading debate in order to accommodate those that have put forward amendments. And I do think that we should reflect on the role of this House in holding this government to account. I've added my name to a number of the amendments, particularly those drafted by my friend, the member for Streatham, and I pay tribute to her for the work she's done on this bill and the contribution that she's made this afternoon. At the moment, there is still going on the Mitting inquiry into undercover policing operations, which succeeded the Pitchford inquiry after the death of Pitchford. That inquiry was due to report in 2018. It has not even got into the second and third stages of its inquiries yet, and may well go on for several years more before it reports. It covers undercover policing since 1968, which I reflect is more or less covers my whole political life for that time. So I'm going to read with great interest the final report of the Mitting inquiry. But what's come out so far, and what has come out from those of us that have good friends in environmental groups, in human rights groups, in trade unions, and many other campaigns, is the sheer arrogance of police undercover operations that have infiltrated wholly legitimate and legal operations in order to disrupt them, spread negative information, and cause problems for them. If we live in a free and democratic society, obviously criminality is not acceptable. Obviously, policing is required to deal with criminality, but you don't deal with criminality by authorising criminality through undercover policing operations into those groups. And those of us that have had the honour of meeting people, particularly women, in a number of groups that have been infiltrated by the police, and the police have then knowingly formed liaisons, sexual liaisons with those women. Children have been given birth to as a result of it. And then often years later, the woman concerned finds out that she was completely duped, completely misled, and her life was ruined by an undercover police operation. Imagine what it feels like if you've been with what you thought was your life partner for several years and you discover they've been put there by the police in order to seduce you into giving information on actually legal activities done by environmental and other groups. Does this bill protect women from that in the future? I think we all know the answer to that, and I hope that at the very least the House of Lords is able to make some substantial amendments to this. But I'm disappointed that the College of Policing advice just come out is that it is not necessarily wrong for undercover officers to form sexual relations with people in order to gain information. This is the kind of world that we are about to approve of unless the amendments that have been put forward by my friend and my friend the member for Walthamstow and others are accepted by the government today. I will be brief, Madam Speaker, Deputy Speaker, because I know there isn't much time and there's 11 more colleagues trying to speak before 20 past three. The second area I want to refer to are the points made by my friend the Member for Streatham. This bill says that you cannot do anything to undermine the economic well-being of the country. Well, what does that actually mean? Does that mean, for example, that if dock workers decided to take strike action because they'd reached the end of the road on negotiations with their employer and therefore they were withdrawing their labour in order to force a settlement of their grievance, would they be acting against the economic interests of this country because it would obviously disrupt trade, or are they acting in the interests of themselves and their colleagues and other workers in trying to improve their economic well-being? There's a whole big debate about what is economic well-being and what is not. And for those of us that have seen the activities of undercover police operations in trade unions and the blacklisting of wholly legitimate trade union representatives who have spent 20 years and more being unable to work as electricians, as carpenters, as plumbers, because they've been blacklisted secretly by groups of employers when the police knew about it all along. Wholly illegal activities, and the need for the police to recognise what they've been doing is completely wrong is simply unacceptable. So I hope that we'll have a thought for the moment at the more than 1,000 groups that have been infiltrated by the police at some point over the past few years. 1,000 different groups have been infiltrated in some way. And those of us that have spent our lives campaigning for social justice, environmental sustainability, and against racism in any form often wonder why there is apparently much less concern and much less involvement and much less attention paid to far-right racist organisations than there are to other people within our society. I think we need to know the answers to all of these questions, but I suspect we will not get them today. My friend the member for Rhondda has put forward an amendment which says that activities should in future be authorised only by the Prime Minister, and my friend for Streatham has also put forward amendments on the question of accountability. Accountability is absolutely the key to this. I wonder if ministers actually knew or know what was going on. I wonder if senior police officers always knew what was going on. I wonder how many different quasi-secret operations were being conducted in different police authorities around the country without the relevant police commander even knowing what is happening. And the inquiries into South Yorkshire, over Orgreave and of Hillsborough tend to indicate there is a lack of transparency in the way in which the police operate. The member for Holton, Price and Howden spoke very correctly about the whole issues of where we go to if we go down a road of ignoring human rights and civil justice within our society. He and I spent a lot of time campaigning to try and get British nationals and British residents released from Guantanamo Bay. It's a disgrace, the whole thing. The whole thing is extrajudicial in every conceivable way. Likewise, we were involved in extraordinary rendition of some form as this country and our government here. If we're to hold our heads up around the world as being supporters of human rights, of being signatories to the Universal Declaration, to the European Convention, and to our own Human Rights Act, then I think we need to look very carefully at ourselves and what this bill actually proposes to do today. And so I would hope that at the very least, when the minister comes to reply, he will make it very clear whether the government is committed to continuing to support, recognise and work within the terms of the very historic and important Human Rights Act, or if once again he's going to be appealing to the backwards people in the Tory party who sort of see human rights as somehow or other a term of abuse and they want to repeal that act or reduce its power and its importance. I think these things are very important. I regret, Madam Deputy Speaker, we've had such a very short time for this crucial debate today, but I'm moved by the hundreds of people that have been in touch with MPs about this, the dozens of organisations, not necessarily all protest groups or on the left, but covering peace, covering civil liberties, covering human rights, that are very, very concerned about this bill. These are people that think very seriously about these matters, and we would do well to listen to them rather than ramming this thing through in a few hours on a Thursday afternoon and imagining that will be job done. It won't be, because it will all get back in the courts at points in the future. The Metting Inquiry report will come out at some point in the future, and many of us will continue our vigilance in order to protect civil liberties and human rights in our society, in our country, and the civil liberties and rights of those who work in the police and other security services. Thank you, Madam Deputy Speaker.
So that's the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, now backbencher, speaking his entire speech yesterday, because he covered so much ground in that little speech, Martin. He's talking, I think, in a very wide range about all of the different implications of this incredible, unprecedented piece of legislation, which was rammed through, as he said yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite extraordinary. You've got a majority of 80 for the Tory government, but of course they only got 43% of the vote at the last election, and they're ramming this through in defiance of the left wing of the Labour Party and other opposition
parties.
Well,
it's interesting, isn't it, because the Labour Party was actually subverted, and we know that now, don't we, during the campaign of the general election in 2017 and the end of last year. We know there were covert agents within the Labour Party actually working against the interests of Jeremy Corbyn. So, in a way, one wonders whether some of those were government people or you know, and whether this is a bill which is to cover up the crimes of that.
Well, as you know, Harold Wilson was forced out of office by the security services, even when he was Prime Minister. And that was, you know, anybody who looks into it knows that's what happened. Same thing happened to Gough Whitlam in Australia. And that's the reality. Is this? They've been engaging in criminal activities for years. But they basically, they're now trying to close the loophole whereby they might ultimately be held to account for things that they've done.
Okay, so in the news yesterday, MPs reject attempts to specify in law limits on undercover agents. This is Richard Wheeler, Sophie Morris, George Ryan and Lewis McKenzie at the Press Association in London. Attempts to explicitly ban undercover agents from being authorised to kill, torture or rape have been defeated. MPs voted 256 votes to 213, a majority of 60 against Labour's proposal to specify in the Covert Human Intelligence Sources Criminal Conduct Bill the limits on what agents should be allowed to do. Under the opposition amendment, limits would have included causing death or bodily harm, violating the sexual integrity of a person, and subjecting someone to torture or cruel, inhumane or degrading treatment or punishment. I'm rather shocked to see our own Bristol MPs not included in the list of those opposing this bill, Martin. None of the Bristol Labour MPs opposed it. They all abstained, as they were asked to do by Keir Starmer.
Yes, and I think if Keir Starmer looks at the other opposition parties, and I'm talking now of the Nationalists, the SNP, the Greens, they didn't have any problem in voting against the bill. I think because he's basically trying to appeal to a swing electorate in the so-called red wall seats, he feels that he can't oppose the bill because that's the sort of thing he thinks they want the security services to do. But I mean, ultimately, if you allow the security services an absolute free
rein... It's not just the security services, this, is it? It's the Gambling Commission, Her Majesty's Revenue and Custom, and any government agency, including one that they haven't even set up yet, which is designated by the Home Secretary, that doesn't need to go through Parliament, by executive order.
Yeah. I mean, the deep state in the United Kingdom has been incredibly powerful for years. Anybody in Northern Ireland will tell you, you know, they've been engaged in all sorts of things, including mass murder.
I mean, this is a recipe for dictatorship, effectively. And for anybody that is opposing something that the government's doing, whether they be lawyers, journalists, ordinary individuals, or even politicians, you know, elected politicians, this bill allows that government agency to actually exterminate them.
In theory, they could be assassinated. And of course, people in Northern Ireland were assassinated with the knowledge and cooperation of the security forces. Everybody knows this. But at the same time, everybody knows it, but they don't know it. I find it extraordinary that Tory MPs can think it's okay for people to break the law. It's like, hang on a minute, the law is the law. And even if you break the law, you know, the point is that you've got to do it in such a way that you don't get caught.
I mean, you're right.
And of course, that's in the past is exactly what they did. They broke the law, but they were covered. Everything was covered up, and nobody was ever prosecuted.
I wonder whether this is possibly even worse than the Stasi. I mean, the Stasi at least were regulated in some way in East Germany, Martin. You know, and maybe they did, you know, infiltrate groups, organisations, but I'm not sure that they were going around assassinating people. Were they?
I think they probably did on occasion, absolutely. And I think what would be extraordinary is that the intelligence services in Russia wouldn't be allowed to have these kind of powers because of the history of the country. They basically say that, you know, they're trying to establish a rule of law there, which is quite tricky.
I mean,
it's an uphill struggle.
I was involved very much as an environmental campaigner in the 1990s, and in 1996 we took over a big piece of land in London. We got a lot of publicity around the idea of eco villages rather than massive supermarkets and housing and luxury housing being built next to the Thames in Wandsworth. And then in 1999 we took over a whole piece of land at St George's Head in Surrey in the 350th anniversary of the diggers who were in the English Civil War, wanted to make the earth a common treasury for all. They were also called themselves the True Levellers, so they were involved in the English Civil War political struggles and faith struggles, and we decided we wanted to do that. Amazingly, we had 350 people turned up on the march exactly 350 years after it, which was great fun. But we were, many of us who were involved in doing that action back in 99 believe, and there's a guy, there were two people that infiltrated, we believe, that campaign. One of them I won't mention because I think she's still alive, but one guy who we've been told has died, a guy called Brendan Bowl, he turned up on site. He wasn't telling the police exactly what we were doing, but then he proceeded to really fracture the organisation afterwards and set everybody against each other, including ditching loads of the campaign's equipment. Throwing it into a ditch. And we lost loads of our stuff that we'd been donated and everything because Brendan had just dumped it. But so, you know, we obviously are suspicious that something was going on there, Martin.
Well, I think anybody who's been involved in the various social movements in this country over the years are very well aware that we've been infiltrated at every stage. I mean, basically, it's come out that the special demonstration squad from the police has literally had hundreds of infiltrators in virtually everything you can think of.
I mean, for us environmentalists, the interesting thing about it was we were suspicious about people who were infiltrating our little land rights group, but we at the time assumed that this would probably be the big vested interests, like the Country Landowners Association, people like that. But it now looks as if they had managed to strong-arm the police to doing their dirty work for them.
Well, I think we've got to presume that that both things are going on. You know, the campaign against the arms trade were infiltrated, the National Union of Mine Workers were infiltrated, Roger Windsor was working for MI5 for years when he was Scotland's
right-hand
man.
But I suppose these big private interests would much rather the police do this for several reasons. One, they don't have to pay, and secondly, the police are probably going to be a lot better at protecting themselves from any recourse to law afterwards if they're found out.
Yes, and of course we're concentrating now upon, you know, essentially what are legitimate political activities in Britain, but of course in Ireland and elsewhere they have been involved in mass murder. The bombings of Dublin and Monaghan in 1972 were orchestrated via the Glenane gang, but it was definitely MI5, that's what the Garda Síochána believe. They killed 27 people and injured hundreds of others. All totally.
Well, I think
civilians.
It's. You have to say, you know, the same sort of thing was going on from the other side, wasn't it? There was murders on both sides, Martin.
Well, indeed, that's the point I'm making is that most people imagine that there was that the IRA were murdering people, but that the British state didn't.
I mean, the most
Whereas
horrific.
The British state did.
The most horrific things, you know, were the sectarian killings, where someone was killed just for their either religious or political allegiance.
Well, indeed,
nothing to do with
indeed,
whether
indeed.
They
if
were
you read Nemesis, I've forgotten the guy's name who wrote it. It was in the SAS, and he said, "Well, we were eventually just driving around in Catholic areas just shooting people at random, and that's all that was what they were doing." And ultimately, of course, you see, if you're going to have a rule of law in Balthazar Garzón in Spain, when the socialists were in power in the 1990s, he accused the then interior minister Inigo of organizing death squads in the Basque region, GAL as they called them, and he found him guilty and he sent him to prison. And ultimately, of course, the Royal Ulster Constabulary was disbanded and the Peace Service of Northern Ireland was set up so that there should be a genuine rule of law.
Okay, the Nemesis file. Martin, the Nemesis file, I remember reading this a few years ago, and it's actually pretty extraordinary. It's even got colour ordnance survey maps in the book, in the pictures in the middle of the book, which show you whereabouts bodies were buried and this sort of thing. His name's Paul Bruce. Apparently, he was a tough, idealistic young trooper in the SAS when he was dispatched to Northern Ireland. His squad's top secret mission, code sign Nemesis, to execute unarmed IRA suspects in cold blood. And these were just suspects, people they thought he might be in the IRA, so they executed them.
Yeah, they also kill people at random, and that's the point at which he decided to walk
bound,
away and write a book.
This is a way to fuel a civil war, isn't it? You don't actually stop a civil war.
Well, that's what he says in the book, is when we were going around just shooting people at random, we're pouring fuel on the fire rather than getting rid of key people. But of course, if you're going to get rid of key people, you can say you're doing, but it is illegal.
So you can't deny that.
But of course, now, of course, something like that would be covered by this bill, and the people could be protected, as the UDA people who killed Finucane were protected.
What it suggests to me is that the people that organised and carried out these assassinations and murders in the past are now in charge of our legislation.
Yes, I think what's happening is because...
They're criminals.
Yes, they are criminals. And Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who's head of the Force Research Unit, which was very heavily involved in all of this, Sir John Stevens recommended that he should be prosecuted. But he wasn't prosecuted. And, of course, he's escaped. I mean, John Ware, Panorama programmes exposed what his role was. And you could argue that, you know, he did no more or less than what the IRA people did. But the IRA people did 25 years in prison, or they got assassinated, and ultimately, you know, they had to have a deal to get them out of the prison. Whereas, of course, the assassins on the state side not only don't get prosecuted, they get promoted, and they get paid a pension at the state's expense, which is our expense. And ultimately, of course, if you give people a carte blanche like that, then they will abuse it.
Anyway, John.
That's why you shouldn't give it to
John Finucane is the son of Pat Finucane. He's who was murdered by loyalist terrorists, encouraged to do so by British security forces. He was a Republican lawyer, and so Martin. He was murdered, Pat Finucane, in 1989 at his family home by loyalist paramilitaries. A murder that BBC News called one of the most controversial killings during the Troubles. And we're going to hear now from his son, who's also a Sinn Féin, he has now become a Sinn Féin politician, John Finucan, who was not really allowed to finish much of his sentences when he was on yesterday on the BBC's Today programme.
What alarms the majority of people about this bill is how far it goes. It doesn't place any prohibition on sexual crime, on torture, and it places no prohibition on murder. What essentially it's trying to do is provide legal immunity for the worst cases of criminality that people can imagine. And cases such as ours, the murder of my father, the murder of a lawyer in front of his family, would receive no judicial oversight, would receive no journalistic oversight, would have no mechanism by which people are held to account, because it is in effect legalising what the Prime Minister David Cameron described as shocking levels of collusion, what the British government have previously described as one of the darkest periods in our history. The government has already made it very clear that the Human Rights Act wouldn't apply, so essentially it rides both horses. What it wants to do is to seek the power to authorise agents to commit the criminality that I have just described, but it doesn't want the responsibility that comes with that. The government has made its position very clear that it would not be responsible for the actions of agents, and the Human Rights Act would not apply. I think that the danger of this bill is that what you are essentially doing is passing on the power of self-regulation to agencies that have proven time and time again that they are just not capable of having such a power, whether it's the security services, whether it's the MOD, or whether it's the police here. They are not capable of exercising that responsibility. And it almost asks a question that there is a premise of responsibility and moderation. That's simply not the case. Whether you're looking at the conflict here or whether you're looking at the spy cop scandal in England, that simply did not happen. And that's why this bill is so dangerous.
Okay, so that's John Finucane, son of Pat Finucane, speaking on the Today programme yesterday morning. I mean, he's really saying there, spelling it out for anyone that needed to realise it, that they're asking in this bill the criminal justice system, those working for the government, to be responsible in this. But they've already proved through these various criminal activities in the past that they're not responsible, and they can't be handed that responsibility.
Well, I totally agree with that, but I'd go further. Of course, if we're going to get on top of things like Islamist terrorism, we've got to look at its linkages back to our own security forces. And what we really need is independent police investigation of these so-called Islamist incidents like the Manchester bombing, because, of course, our own intelligence services have got their fingers in that pie. And if we want to control this kind of terrorism, we've got to independently investigate it. So it's not just a question. You see, all these Tory MPs who voted with this are voting on the presumption that the security services and the armed forces are there to prevent terrorism, and therefore they must be given the powers necessary, including criminal powers. But in actual fact, in many cases, they are the terrorists, and therefore they should be prosecuted, and therefore the police should be independent of the government and independent of the security forces, and therefore capable of investigating when they commit crimes. Because that is where a lot of this is actually rooted. It's not just that they need extra powers to deal with criminals and terrorists. They are the criminals and the terrorists.
So is this a sort of last gasp because of the massive Tory majority by people who are criminal networks, hiding within government circles, within the criminal justice system? Is this their last gasp?
Well, no, it's not the last gasp. What it is as we've seen with the Assange case, which has got no basis in English law whatsoever, is that we are basically legislating for dictatorship. And, of course, as the economy crashes, the banks go down, we go to war with Iran to keep the Israelis happy, there's going to be protest, and it's going to be infiltrated, and there may be bomb attacks, and people may die, and we won't be able to investigate them properly, because the people doing it are covered by this.
You would find it difficult to investigate it anyway in those sorts of circumstances, but we're saying here that there's going to be no legal cover for anybody investigating this whatsoever. So even if you did investigate it, nothing's going to happen.
That's right. And of course, what that means is that the people involved, you see, there is some kind of deterrence involved in this. So the loyalist paramilitaries were well aware that they were getting loads of information from the British Army. British Army are basically steering them, but they try and keep a hands-off relationship with them, and they try to cover their tracks as far as possible because they think that there could be some investigation further down the line. And of course, people like Stalker and Sir John Stevens did come from abroad, from this side of the water, to investigate. But this, once they've got this on the statute book, they don't have to worry about that at all.
Well, they do,
I
think.
They can just go out and do what they want.
If and when there are investigations into any of these sorts of things in the future, the only recourse is going to be to the gun.
Well, that's right, because of course they make the case for that clearly. Because if there is no legal recourse against these things, then that makes the terrorist case quite clearly, doesn't it?
So the other thing, of course, is we're living through an era, an epoch, the last few years anyway, with the last people survivors of the Second World War dying, Martin. It looks as if we're going to have potentially anyway a kind of dictatorship emerging here in Britain. So maybe all that was for nothing.
Well, you could say that, Tony. I think the fact is we're in a very desperate situation now.
Surely there are these war memorials across the country, aren't there? I mean, what do they actually mean if people were fighting only to see a dictatorship and tyranny start to emerge here in Britain?
I think Tory MPs need to look into their hearts and say, how can you possibly legislate for people to be allowed to commit crimes? You know, I mean, that's just extraordinary. Why would you give people the right to commit crimes? Now, what you've got in the US, of course, is, for example, that each president can pardon 200 people on their last few weeks in power. And of course, what they do is they then pardon all sorts of criminals who then walk free. I mean, I don't know why they do that, but they do it. But I mean, it's an extraordinary thing that people are given the right to break the law. I mean, who's got the right to break the law?
Well, the actual passage of the bill, there are two stages left of it, actually. There's one at the House of Lords, the third reading, I think it is, in the House of Lords. So they will have a little debate about this, probably very short, curtailed, and then whether the Queen will put her name to it too, and then it gets a royal assent, and then it will become law. I'm not quite sure exactly when. But you were just talking about the states there, Martin. Joanna Cherry, MP from the SNP, pointed out that actually this goes much further than is even allowed by the FBI in the United States.
The approach which the UK government wants to railroad through in this bill stands in really quite stark contrast to that of two of our closest allies, the United States of America and Canada, who of course are two of our closest Five Eyes intelligence partners. The Canadian Parliament prohibits serious offences from these sort of authorisations, including murder, torture, violating the sexual integrity of an individual, and so on. Canada's intelligence service can only use their authorisation process to give agents a defence to prosecution rather than any blanket immunity. And in America, the FBI has for many years run agents using guidelines that expressly ban certain criminal conduct. And according to guidelines issued by the US Attorney General, the FBI may never authorise an informant to participate in any act of violence except in self-defence. So the approach of the United Kingdom government here is really without precedent. And that's why I and my colleagues in the SNP won't be taking any lectures from the government front bench or back bench about our commitment to the security of these nations or indeed the prosecution of serious crime.
That's SNP MP Joanna Cherry, Martin, saying, well, I suppose what many of us are thinking, and it's amazing that the big networks don't seem to consider this is really news. It's totally unprecedented.
Well, it is, but I think from Starmer's point of view, he ought to take account of the fact that the other opposition parties have all found it perfectly acceptable to vote against this. The Tories can force it through because they've got a majority of 80. But why do you have to abstain and prevent them from, you know, the opposition parties, in my view, should simply vote against it. They push it through anyway.
With a few Tory rebels like David Davis and people like that, they probably could have stopped this.
Well, I think that was the argument in relation to the war crimes bill, was that if we could get some Tory rebels who have got some civil liberties orientation, then we can perhaps modify it or change it. But I think what's actually happening is that the security services are becoming very much overmighty subjects in this country.
But it's not just them, is it?
No, they are the coordinating body for wider criminal groups, frankly, the people that have that basically crashed the banking system and then got bailed out by the taxpayer and all the rest of it. And it's just a sign of the gradual hollowing out of the democratic facade of the British state.
I can remember a book, I think it was around about 2012. Yes, it was 2012. It came out, Untouchables, Dirty Cops, Bent Justice and Racism in Scotland Yard. Now, what do you, it was Michael Gillard and Laurie Flynn. Actually, I think it was, gosh, it was a while ago, probably 5 years ago, Martin, but we did have interviews with both of those authors on this programme, on BCFM. They were really saying that there was a hardcore of criminals within Scotland Yard who it was impossible for the authorities to do anything about because they had much more access to better lawyers and more money, so they had to leave them alone.
Well, I think it was it Sir Robert Marks when he took over in the Metropolitan Police, said the bad news is... a third of my officers are corrupt. The good news is we know which ones they are and we're keeping an eye on them. And that is actually the truth of the way things are. This is not a bill to kind of prevent criminality. It's a bill to help criminals to get their way. And I think it's extraordinary that there's going to be rule bending and all sorts of things going on anyway, but giving people carte blanche from the get-go that anything they do is not going to be prosecutable is basically asking for them to just go out and do whatever they want.
So we've got a situation in Britain right now where the best way to rob a bank is to just own one. In fact, they're the biggest bank robbers out there. And the best way to commit a crime is to become a policeman.
Well, that's what the implication of all this is. And I find it quite extraordinary that anybody who's had any kind of civic education can accept that the government gives carte blanche to criminal behaviour. Why do we have courts? The courts are supposedly independent of the government, and that's the check and balance.
Our institutions are pretty rotten, aren't they? For example, the church being infiltrated by paedophiles, the BBC being infiltrated, Prince Charles' circle being infiltrated by paedophiles. These sorts of things actually tally quite well, in a way, with the establishment institutions being absolutely rotten to the core.
Well, the King Cora Boys Home was used by MI5 to blackmail various political figures in Northern Ireland, and they basically used children in the home as expendable tools, and they were they were basically sold for sex to the people that MI5 were targeting.
Anyway,
that is criminal behaviour. Another MP, and people should have been prosecuted.
Who spoke up against this bill is Alastair Carmichael, a Lib Dem MP.
Amendment number 15, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chairman, I beg your pardon, deals with the question of economic grounds. As things stand, the bill allows crimes to be authorised if they are necessary, quote, in the interests of the economic well-being of the United Kingdom. Now, that conjures up all sorts of delicious prospects. You know, if it's decided that we maybe need another... or a different governor of the Bank of England. Can we authorise a Chiz to wipe him out? Or if we decided, for example, that maybe a no-deal Brexit was not to be in the economic interests of the United Kingdom, would this be something which could be used? The possibilities... there are at least two or three good Netflix series in this, I'm pretty certain. The possibilities... are almost endless. But, you know, what crimes might be authorised to entice a foreign investor to bring their money to the United Kingdom or a car manufacturer to keep its UK plant open? Because, of course, there's nothing here to stop corruption or bribery to be used in these circumstances.
That's the Lib Dem MP, Alistair Carmichael, speaking yesterday in the Covert Human Intelligence Sources Bill. Martin, this is 2 hours and 20 minutes long, as Gavin Robinson, another MP, says.
There are circumstances in which, regrettably, life is lost. And there are circumstances in which it is legitimate for the state to remove life. And I do not say that to be controversial. That is a part of our human rights framework. But I do have to say that this process with 2 hours, 20 minutes of debate for committee stage is wholly unsatisfactory. These issues are much too important, to be left to 2 hours and 20 minutes of a debate.
So that was the DUP Member of Parliament, Gavin Robinson there. Even though, Martin, he's speaking for the bill, he's saying this is ridiculous. You can't debate something which is unprecedented, momentous importance, basically turning the whole idea of the rule of law upside down in 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Well, obviously you can, and that's what they're doing. I imagine that this bill has been basically prepared by the intelligence services for some time, and they're rushing it through because they've got the opportunity to get it on the statute book. Pretty much like the Patriot Act in the United States, which was passed NEMCON virtually, and it was, you know, it's a huge act, got loads and loads of clauses in it, and it obviously just been sitting there ready to go, and after 9/11 it was just ran through. And this is exactly what happened in Germany in the 1930s. Where basically was passed through the Reichstag that the state should have the power to do various things like this, and after that the Nazi regime was in full control of the society. I'm not suggesting that the Tories are Nazis, but the idea that the security services, who we know have been involved in bombings, assassinations, infiltration, and all sorts of things, most of which they've got away with, even though it's all on the record, why should we give those kind of people a blank check? Totally unreasonable.
Okay, moving on to the day before, which is Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday. Let's have a listen now to the local lockdowns discussion. This has been actually still brewing, Martin. It's all sorts of heated negotiations before we hear from PMQs this week. It's almost as if there's a deals are being done, which doesn't seem quite right to me with the mayors of the north of England. And central government and Rishi Sunak. So basically it's like, well, if you give us enough money, then we'll have a second lockdown. But this isn't really necessarily the right thing to do, is it? Surely they should just be following whatever the actual best clinical advice is, having a proper open discussion about it, making all their evidence public as to why they're doing it, and then just doing what needs doing, rather than having some sort of game where money is changing hands and there's not enough money, and if you put another million on the table, we'll have another lockdown.
Well, it's turning into a bit of a shit show, which I think we can say on because we're not on under Ofcom rules. I mean, you can see that nobody's really sure what's supposed to be going on now, what the basis of any decisions made are. And, you know, as you can see, Starmer has decided to nail his colours to the mast, saying we should have a circuit breaker lockdown, which is what Sage recommended 3 weeks ago. And of course, politically, that puts Sunak and Johnson on the back foot, because they either ultimately do that, in which case Starmer's called for it first, or they don't, in which case they get the blame as
so,
it goes down the drain.
The latest on this is that Boris Johnson today has been threatening to force Manchester into lockdown. Now, the problem here is, if you've got a political system in your city and a population that are not going to accept it and that don't wish to accept it, I mean, surely there has to be some sort of understanding that this is something that people are doing willingly, rather than just being told, you're going to have a lockdown, we're not going to tell you why, do it, or we're going to arrest and fine you.
Yeah, and I think the main point that they are making, and I think this ought to be clearly understood by everybody, is if you are going to have lockdowns, you have got to basically pay people's wages. You can't just say Liverpool has a lockdown, but Surrey, where I'm going to my golf club, we're going to carry on doing everything we want to do. It creates a huge kind of resentment, especially if you're not going to pay people. You know, if the government is saying you've got to close the pub, that means you've got to pay the wages of the staff. And of course, the Tories want to put the lockdowns through, but they're getting a bit of cold feet now about providing the resources necessary if that's what they want to do. And that's caused a lot of the anger.
What I'm trying to say here is, I mean, if you've seen the footage during the week in Liverpool, for example, when they had their tier three, they call it. I mean, it's obvious the words they use here, tear, a little cry, something to make you even more sad and upset. Three tears. You know, the people were actually coming out onto the streets in Liverpool, surrounding police cars and this sort of thing, in a very rebellious mood. It doesn't look as if the people of Liverpool are going to be accepting this.
I think that's one of the problems you've got at this stage. At the early stages of this, people were willing to listen to what the government was saying, whether they voted for them or not, and they were willing because they, you know, some explanation was being given about what was happening and why. I think that the government has basically used up all of their political capital. You know, we're going to hear about Serco later in the programme. I mean, people just do not trust that they're making the right decisions for the right reasons, and they seem clearly to be overruling. I mean, they decided on this 10 p.m. curfew because they were being advised that they ought to close the pubs down completely, and they didn't want to do that, so they went for a 10 p.m. curfew, which is basically pointless. I mean, it doesn't change anything. There's no point. You might, if you're going to have them open, you might as well have them open. If you're going to have them closed, have them closed.
Now, I mentioned last week about our own mayor, Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees. He gave his State of the City address this week, which I always think he pinched from us, basically. Back in about 2009 or 2008, I started this thing called the State of the City Reports. Now Marvin is doing his State of the City address every year. I mean, we're not going to have any extracts from it. Not because, you know, I haven't gotten round to it, just because it's so boring. I mean, it's this management speak Marvin comes out with, which just doesn't really end up saying anything. It's all kind of, you know, trying to big up some plan which nobody really understands, and all sorts of great objectives and backslapping. So if anyone is looking to get, we've got a bit of insomnia, it's about an hour long speech, and I can guarantee at the end of that speech you will be fast asleep, even if it's the middle of the day when you're listening to it. But Marvin Rees, Martin, this week is actually calling for powers to lock Bristol down, even though we have the lowest in the country actual rates of COVID. So he's looking up north jealously at the mayors that are locking down up there, thinking, I want to do that here in Bristol.
Well, I don't know exactly what he said, so it's hard to comment. But I mean, he'll be set. I mean, one of the problems is that when all this kicked in, they could have used the local authorities' test and trace teams as the key to setting up your system. And that's exactly what they've done in Germany and elsewhere. Instead, they decided to start from scratch by giving the contracts to set up test and trace and to make decisions about lockdown to the private sector. And the people who are making the decisions on the test and trace, they've got hardly any local authority experts or medical experts in there. A lot of them are basically private sector panjum drums. And why would they be the people to decide what to do about things like
this? So in the letter to central government, Marvin has been saying he asked them to give us a lot more local autonomy, which is not just about Bristol City Council, but about us working in Bristol with our universities, the police, and talking about how we manage our city. So it's the collection of organisations. So he's not saying just he wants it. And one thing he's been absolutely outspoken about is that the 10 p.m. curfew is a disaster, because, or not even curfew, but it's turning people all out of pubs at the same time. He said he wouldn't do that here.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think there's a lot of disquiet about that. It doesn't make any sense, does it? It seems to imply that COVID is like some kind of vampire that only comes out after 10 o'clock at night.
In fact, there's a good argument for letting pubs open very late, because then you get a really staggered, well, not people will be staggering, obviously, because they'll be drunk, but a staggered exit from all these various drinking houses, restaurants and things like that. So people are just not on top of each other. And also, if they can drink in these safe COVID spaces, then they're not going to be disappearing around people's houses and having these little covert parties.
Yes, and I'm you know, I mean, you know, so many things have been done wrong at so many turning points in this crisis.
One does wonder if this is an attempt, actually, to discredit the whole idea of elected governments, both in our city, up north, and central government, have come out of this whole thing incredibly badly. And, I mean, it looks as if, what with this covert security bill, it's going to be even worse. Isn't what's happening, actually, an attempt to discredit the whole democratic process, the whole democratic system, and, of course, the people that will benefit from that are your Davos types, your Bilderberg types, the big corporates that want to bring in a corporatocracy anyway.
Well, the strategy of tension in Italy in the 70s and the 80s and going on right up to the present day, what you do is you're basically hollowing out whatever democratic powers exist, and ultimately there's going to be a massive crisis of capitalism. We're already in the middle of it, and the deep state, which is basically representing the corporate interests, is preparing the legal instruments by which the population will be repressed if they rebel against it. That's pretty clear, isn't it?
So let's go to Wednesday and Keir Starmer at Prime Minister's Questions now.
Mr. Speaker, I've just listened to what the Prime Minister said about his strategy to get R below one, but I can't think of a single scientist who backs him. He will know that the Chief Medical Officer said on Monday that he, his words, Chief Medical Officer, not confident, nor is anyone confident, that the Tier 3 proposals for the highest rate would be enough. That's Tier 3. That's Tier 3, the highest tier. So why is the Prime Minister so confident that his approach will get the R rate below 1, so confident, or is that no longer the government plan?
Minister,
I'm afraid, Mr. Speaker, he is misrepresenting the position. Doubtless inadvertently, what our advice is that if the regional measures are Tier 3 all at all levels were implemented in full, with the support and the active cooperation of local leaders, as indeed we have seen from the leader of Liverpool City Region, and I pay tribute to him and I thank him for what he is doing. If we saw full and proper enforcement, if they were able to conduct proper local test and trace with the support of the £500 million that we're giving, then yes, those measures would deliver, Mr. Speaker, the reduction in the R locally, regionally, that we need in order to avert what none of us want to see, except now the Right Honourable Gentleman having performed this extraordinary U-turn. None of us want to see, and that is the disaster, the words of the Shadow Health Spokesman, of a national lockdown. We don't want to go there. We want the regional approach. He should cooperate with it.
Do you want a national lockdown, Martin?
I think that's probably where we're going to end up, whether I want it or not. I think the problem for the government is that if they're forced into a national lockdown, having said that they don't want one, then they're going to look very as if they don't know what they're doing. But I'm afraid they don't know what they're doing. And we probably will, I imagine, I'm just guessing, I think there probably will be some kind of circuit breaker lockdown over Christmas. They were going to have one over half term, but it's too late to even bring that in now.
Isn't this actually a part of a psychological operation to just ruin people's lives, to upset people, to destroy people's morale?
Well, it's certainly destroying people's morale and lives are being ruined, but I don't think that, and there is a plan behind it all. We were talking about it earlier. You know, the 9/11 attacks were carried out by the US security forces in order to terrorize the population. That what's happened with COVID is a lot of this is actually just serial incompetence by the government.
Well, it's not just that, is it? Because there's a lot of questions about the testing. Michael Yeadon, for example, he brought that up, and we'll be hearing what the whistleblower from GCHQ, Catherine Gunn, has to say about his work in a minute. That whole idea that the tests are honest and truthful, I was amazed to see the BBC going round to students and handing out tests, almost as if they want students to be testing, and you test as many people as possible, you'll find potentially any way false positives, and you can bump the rate up. And in fact, if these people accept these tests, not only would they if they get a false positive have to lock down themselves, they'll have to have a whole cascade of other people being locked down. So there is a real serious doubt about whether the what we're seeing is not, because the death rate is going up, it's creeping up, isn't it? But there is another possible explanation for that, and that is because all the people who have been going to hospital for the last 2 months or so have been being tested. So everybody that goes into hospital gets a COVID test. If we're getting false positives, there's your death rate going up, because these people who are dying of other things are also being put on the COVID list, the COVID death list.
Well, I mean, if we're going to make specific allegations about testing not being accurate, then that's got to be proven, hasn't it? You can't.
Well,
just
we did it a few weeks ago. Michael Yeadon, Dr. Michael Yeadon from Pfizer. He was the top guy in Pfizer. He's saying that these are totally unreliable, these PCR tests. They amplify bits of RNA and DNA, which are basically dead viruses. So they stick this thing right into your nose, right back into your throat. And these little bits of virus that were killed off maybe months ago, still lingering around in your snot, if I'm allowed to say that, those would test as a positive test. That's what the Pfizer guy was saying.
Well, I certainly accept that the more people you test, the more positives you're going to find. And of course, it may be that there's loads of people out there who've had COVID or got COVID who haven't been tested at all. So, you know, the more tests you do, the more of it you're going to find, aren't you? For obvious reasons. I think the reason why we're getting this you know, sort of panic setting in is because the hospitalizations and death rates are going up. That tends to imply however many people have got it, it's going in the wrong direction. And that's why you then have to take steps to bring it back down again.
So before we hear from my favourite MP, Zara Sultana, this week, I'm going to try and get a clip of her in every week if I possibly can. We're going to backtrack a little bit, Martin, to the Manchester Arena inquiry is still chugging along. And this, of course, is another potential place where government, state-controlled criminals conducted an attack. What's your, in a nutshell, your worries about the Manchester Arena bombing?
Well, the minimum you can say is that the perpetrator, if he was the only perpetrator, was part of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. And the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group have been based in Manchester since the 1980s. They were key players in the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and they were used as potential murderers of Gaddafi. We're going to hear something from Gaddafi later. That's why Shayla and Annie Machon quit from MI5 and went to, well, they tried to talk to Robin
Cook. Well, they blew the whistle, didn't they?
They blew the whistle on what was going on. But the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who are, you know, basically Al-Qaeda Libya, have been working closely with MI5 and MI6 going back to the 1980s. So the minimum that you could say is that by encouraging these groups to settle in Manchester, you've basically let in people who are not to be trusted and are going to do stupid things like blow up Ariana Grande concerts.
Interesting.
But of course it could be, I would argue, quite possibly the case, that MI5 and MI6 have got a hand in the bombing.
Well, yes. I mean,
just as they had a hand in the bombings in Dublin and Monaghan in 1972.
This is the trouble.
And then, of course, they don't want more power to deal with bombings, but they're the ones who are doing the bombings. That's certainly what was going on in Italy.
One does wonder what the hell MI5 are doing when Salman Abedi was reported to the anti-terrorist hotline before this attack, and yet they were saying, oh, well, he was a clean skin. And they're just basically obviously lying. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Manchester Arena, some of the survivors from the inquiry who were interviewed by Five Live a few weeks ago. And the main point here, I think, is to do with their specific allegation that people were just not treated. So there were as a long period of at least an hour when the ambulance and the fire people were prevented from getting into the site by a combination of, your guess who, anti-terrorist police and the private security at the venue. So Martin, the anti-terrorist police and the private security at the venue actually could have killed people by simply not letting people in to treat the victims.
And that could be because they're basically cleaning the site to make sure that their fingerprints are removed from what's happened.
It was like a horror movie. There were kids screaming, there were kids injured on the floor, there was people around them, they were all crying. I had Xander with me. He had hold of the dog, and I believe there's a photograph of us both, you know, and we were both the shock on our faces because of what we were watching, you know, what we were looking at. I'm going to tell you and describe what was happening that night. Everybody froze. Nobody had any control of what to do.
You don't feel they were in command of it?
They weren't in command of it. I was walking around with an 11-year-old child and a chihuahua. I asked every police officer that I went past. They just said, just keep looking.
You didn't know that they were just yards away inside?
Yeah. My daughter and my wife were lying on this floor. Do you know how that feels? I could have been with them. Particularly Safi, could have been holding a hand instead of a stranger. Imagine how she was feeling lying there.
You were inside, didn't you?
I was inside. I had a bolt in the back of my neck, which completely paralysed me. All I could do was blink. And I remember lying there thinking, it's OK, help will be here soon. And in the end, it felt like I was lying there for hours. Why is nobody coming?
You've been to three hospitals?
Mm-hmm.
And you still didn't know where Safi was?
Nope. I've been up all night, looking around, searching everywhere to find where Safi is. I said, could you please let me know what's happened to Safi?
The worst thing for me is if Safi could have been saved.
Do you go over that?
I have done, yeah. To think that not just Safi, the other people, how could they leave injured people in the arena for hours?
That's your main question?
Yeah. I mean, it's just madness.
Some of these hearings are going to be held in private,
mm-hmm,
because of national security.
Of course.
Are you worried that you won't be able to ask the questions there that you'd like to?
Yes.
We've got five or six law firms representing all the families. So if there's five firms, six firms, let's have one barrister from each firm in that room.
Obviously, you're having to put your full trust in the chairman, but this inquiry is not about trust. It should be about transparency.
I mean, this could have happened to any family.
Could have happened to
anyone.
And
it can happen to any family in the future. This is why it's so important for things to change.
Now, I'm reminded, Martin, of someone we've had extensive interviews with on this programme, Graham Fawkes, from the 7/7 attacks, whose son David Fawkes was one of the 52 innocent people killed on that occasion. You were just hearing there from some of the people involved in the Manchester Arena attack. So it's Safi Rufsos was one of 22 people. She was the kiddie who was killed there. The parents, parents you just heard. Safi Rufsos's parents last year said that the payout they were given was an insult for her, for their dead child. £11,000 apparently.
That's shocking, and obviously it's extremely distressing to hear these people's stories. But I find it extraordinary that the elements are going to have to be held in secret because of national security. Now, that wouldn't be that because the guy was actually from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group just happens to be one of MI6's protege organisations, would it? Because that would be quite scary, wouldn't it? And of course, it could be that they've just, you know, because they've been in bed with these people for years, they weren't really keeping an eye on them. At the time this was going on, they were allowing them to go backwards and forwards to Libya to help overthrow Gaddafi, and they were basically working with British Special Forces. Now, that's very embarrassing if that turns out to be the case. But I think this is quite possible, as we know in the 7/7 attacks and the 9/11 attacks, that in actual fact the security services are behind the attacks. And that's why they don't want a proper investigation into it. And of course, what happened in the 7/7 attacks is all the so-called bombers were dead, and therefore there was never a proper investigation into what happened or why. And of course, you know, if we know the history of the relations between Salafi terrorist groups, both here and around the world, they are based out of Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, and these people are our allies. As we speak, British military personnel are cooperating very closely with the Saudi Mukhabarat in killing people in Yemen. This is their stock in trade, and it's quite possible that that's what's being covered up.
Well, here, Mr. Rufsos, you just heard there, said the biggest lesson and wake-up calls should have come from 7/7 and 9/11, the terror attacks in London and New York. He says that if lessons were still being learned in 2020, nothing will ever change. He even said they shouldn't be using my daughter as some sort of terror training exercise.
Yes, and of course that implies that all that's happened here is they've got it wrong and they're not doing the right things. I'll go further than that. I'm quite sure that serious intelligence services all over the world are very well aware of what happened on 9/11. That is clearly carried out by the US security forces. They did it. And so of course, nobody's been punished.
Okay, Martin, what's the motive? What's the purpose of an attack like that if it has been carried out by security services, either British or foreign?
Well, it allows you to invade Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and so on, and take whatever resources you want. Because, of course, most people, ordinary people, would say, well, why are we invading these countries? And we can't find them on the map. We've got no real interest in them. Why would we want to go there? But, of course, once you've got a bloody shirt to wave, you've then got the excuse you need to invade these countries. And, of course, to, ramp up spending on military equipment and to allow a creeping police state. And this is what they called in Italy la strategia di tensione, the strategy of tension, and that's what they were doing in Italy in the 70s. Virtually all terrorism in the 70s and the 80s in Italy was being orchestrated by the secret services. That, to me, that means the British secret services, amongst others. And therefore, they basically carry out terrorist actions through cutouts, left-wing and right-wing, Islamists as well, and then of course they demand more powers to deal with the terrible terrorists, and of course what step by step you're moving towards is a totalitarian state. Of course that's what it's about.
So there's also facts relating to the Manchester Arena bombing, such as the changing of the story of the fire brigade, saying that first of all they were saying, we were prevented from coming into the building, and then a couple of weeks ago we hear an apology from the fire chief saying, oh, we're very sorry we didn't get in there in time. Actually, it wasn't the fire brigade's fault at all. It was the anti-terrorist police. So there is also an attempt to shift the blame away for the historical record from the real people who stopped the ambulances and the firemen getting in there, which is the anti-terrorist police, MI5, etc.
Yes, and I think the story they came out was that there was some active shooter operating inside the building. Now, I don't think, how long does it take to work out whether there is or isn't an active shooter?
Well, if there's no one actually firing, or you haven't actually got a specific person, I mean, I don't know.
Well,
maybe the whole idea of an active shooter, which is the same thing as they came up with at the Westminster Bridge attack.
Yeah.
Oh, nobody's allowed to go anywhere because there's an active shooter. It's the people who carried out the attack getting away.
Yes, and also, of course, at the Westminster Bridge attack, they claimed that there was no CCTV footage because Westminster Council, because of austerity, had switched off the CCTV cameras, so we can't actually see what actually happened. Now, what could be going on here is we've got the state basically orchestrating what they call stragi in Italian, in the Italian language, which means state-orchestrated massacres. And then they turn around and say, we need more powers to deal with this terrible threat. And it's a feedback loop that allows the creation of a police state. That's what it's about. And of course it's a gradual process, and it's been going on for years. And of course it's been passed through Parliament, to give the security services complete carte blanche. That is the goal.
I only hope that people like the Roussos family and Graham Fawkes are able to pool their resources in some way and get something done about this, because it seems pretty clear to me that they're both having to put up with the same thing, Martin, which is complete and utter intransigence and no justice whatsoever from the British justice system after an attack like this.
Yes, I mean, people have got to recognise that the security services need to be reined in rather than given more powers. We need independent police investigations by independent police officers, or as in Italy and Spain, through our independent magistrates. Galfio Garzon and Imposimato in Italy, they're independent magistrates. They tried to get to the bottom of what was going on.
So as this Act of Parliament goes through, it gets the Lords, the Covert Intelligence, whatever it is, Security Bill, to enable them to commit crimes, murder, rape, torture, that sort of thing, gets the royal assent. If the Queen, I don't know if the Queen's got a conscience, she won't sign that one, but she's not supposed to have a conscience, is she? The people who committed these attacks, our investigations into 7/7, it's absolutely clear that that was not just four guys from Yorkshire. There was all sorts of other things involved in that, possibly the Israeli intelligence services being behind it. And the Manchester Arena attack, Martin, this is something also that's hardly ever mentioned, is that the London Bridge, the Westminster and the Manchester attacks all happened just in the run-up to a general election. So the idea is to basically dominate the news agenda in the weeks up to a general election.
Yes, and then when you've got the general election out of the way, you can then pass the legislation you want because you've got the results you want. That's clear. I mean, you know, this is what this is about.
The idea is everyone's voting basically on security or not security. This is exactly, by the way, what happened in the mid-1990s in Israel that brought Benjamin Netanyahu to power.
Indeed, and the same thing happened in the 70s and the 80s in Italy. In order to prevent the Democratic Communist Party from having a share in power in Italy, loads of terrorist attacks were carried out, including the assassination of the Prime Minister. But the independent police investigation by Imposimato, as the head of the Supreme Court, showed that this was all being orchestrated by the intelligence services.
Anyway, thank you for indulging me in that little excursion into looking at Manchester Arena and all the things to do with that, particularly on the day where the security services, who were so utterly negligent and have been for all those various families, and also hiding behind little screens, they don't dare even appear in court, have managed to get their horrible bill through, which will enable them to go and commit more crimes with impunity. Let's hear from the antidote to all that, which is this lovely MP from Coventry, Zara Sultana, this week.
Key to stopping the spread of the virus is giving people the financial support they need to self-isolate when they need to. But millions of working people still don't have that. The government's test and trace support payment scheme is totally inadequate. Only a small proportion of workers qualify, and even those who do, at £500 for up to 2 weeks, it's less than the minimum wage. So will the Prime Minister finally do as I urged him back at PMQs in March, raise the statutory sick pay to the real living wage, extend it to cover all workers, and give people the financial security they need to self-isolate?
Mr. Speaker, I just remind her that in addition to the £500, there is also the support of universal credit. And to those who are thinking of not isolating still, I must tell the House that there is a fine of £10,000.
Well, that's great, isn't it? So people with no money can be fined £10,000 if they don't self-isolate. How are you going to get the money off them if they've got no money? I really don't know. But of course, you know, if you look around the world, in China, they basically pay people's wages in full when they told them to self-isolate. And they weren't allowed to be sacked either.
It almost seems as if they're asking for people to come out onto the streets, Martin, you know, because obviously people are just not going to be able to put up with this, having no money, no food, possibly being evicted from their homes and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to have lockdowns, this is what Andy Burnham has been arguing, you've got to basically pay people's wages. And people who are self-employed, you've got to include them in the system. He mentioned universal credit there, but if you put in a universal credit claim, you can't have any money for at least 5 weeks. So there's 5 weeks with no money at all. And then, of course, it's not enough. I mean, Sweden, some people are like the sort of lockdown light they've had in Sweden. But in Sweden, you get 80 to 90% of your previous earnings when you lose your job. And that goes on for quite a long time. They've got a proper welfare state. We've got nothing. And of course, what happens in the big cities in the north, if you look at the health inequalities, it's quite clear that the COVID-19 has been much more devastating in poorer communities where people live in crowded accommodation and work in crowded factories. And of course, they've had more, you know, they've died more and they've been more affected than the leafy suburbs. And if you're going to lock these places down, you've got to give them compensation. Otherwise, the local economy in Liverpool, for example, will be destroyed. And, you know, once this is all over, there'll be nothing there for people to go back to.
Oh, thanks, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look a little bit further around the world.
Messing up your mind, the daily grind, gotta leave it all behind, driving everybody crazy.